But from the end user's experience, are they really concerned about privacy? Are the, you know, the grandparents or your, you know, your nieces and nephews the target customers for these? Are they at the end of the day really consumed about privacy when they are allowing all sorts of other information apps sharing on that on their exact same phones?
Hello and happy Worldwide Developers Conference for those who celebrate. You're listening to Mixture of Experts. I'm your host, Tim Huang. Each week, Mixture of Experts distills down the week's biggest headlines and chatter in the world of artificial intelligence. Whether it's business news, the latest hot drop on Archive, or NVIDIA making another bazillion dollars, MOE is here to give you the analysis you need to navigate this rapidly changing landscape. This week on the show, two items. First up, Apple's WWDC continued a summer of announcements all around artificial intelligence. We'll parse out the biggest things to be paying attention to and what they mean for the industry as a whole. Second, the race for interpretability continues. Weeks after Anthropic demoed Golden Gate Claude, OpenAI fires off its own mechanistic interpretability study. What does it say, and why is OpenAI investing in it at all? As always, I'm joined by an incredible group of experts who will help us cut through the noise and offer their hot takes. Two veterans this time with a new guest. Kautar El-Megrawi, Principal Research Scientist, AI Engineering, AI Hardware Center, and a professor at Columbia. Kautar, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Tim. Glad to be here.
Second, Shobhit Varshney, who will be familiar to longtime listeners of the show, Senior Partner Consulting on AI for US, Canada, and LATAM. Shobhit, welcome back. You're in like a different place every single time, but it's great to have you here.
Thank you.
And then finally, Skylar Speakman, who's a senior research scientist at the Kenya Lab. Skylar, welcome.
I'm going to be even more geeky this time. I'm going to press my luck.
Well, so let's just jump into it. There's two items on the agenda today. And, you know, I think the big one really will be WWDC. There's just been so many announcements. It feels like every single week, every company is doing a raft of new announcements around AI. And I think the background here for folks who haven't been watching Apple so much in the space is that the big thing that everybody's been talking about for a long time is where is Apple in all of this, right? Companies have rushed ahead announcing new products, new features, new research, but Apple has sort of been curiously quiet and, you know, they really have been the 800-pound gorilla in the room, right? They have huge amounts of cash in the bank. They have one of the most successful, you know, obviously mobile operations in the world, and they control hardware, which is incredibly, incredibly key. And so I think what was really fascinating about the announcements at WWDC this week was that we finally, I think, started to get a picture of what Apple's going to do, what the richest, kind of most powerful company in the world is going to be doing in the AI space. And so I think just to set the context a little bit, Shobhit, I want to bring you in first, which is, I guess, to tell our listeners a little bit about why it has taken Apple so long to get to the starting line here. And I guess from the announcements this week, what you think they're trying to do differently, if anything at all.
Big Apple fan. I think at WWDC, it's always a look at what the future is going to bring and within the constraints of what it takes to deliver privacy and trust. They spend decades building that trust. They can't just lose it in a minute. So there's a lot of thought that goes into privacy and how Apple's way of bringing technology into it is. And the litmus test here is always making sure that the advances that they make in innovation are seamless and are frictionless for the end users. So they've been doing AI for a really long time. They have never on stage said the words AI, or they'll talk about their Vision Pro, and not once will they use an industry term like virtual reality. So they've always differentiated themselves from, we're not a technology company, we are in the business of delivering exceptional experiences. So it's not the fact that we have a gyroscope, it is the fact that my Apple Watch has a crash detection thing. That's something that you would want to pay extra for to protect your loved ones, right? So they've always tried to stay away from the technology per se, but they've been doing AI for a very long time. There are a few different ways in which Apple is bringing this in. Classic fashion, they are renaming it, rebranding it as their version of Apple Intelligence, right? That's the cool thing that you want, not the generic AI that everybody else has. They're in a very, very great position of strength. If you think about all the data that's needed for hyper-personalization, it resides on your phone. And if you look at the big companies that have access to intelligence that's in your pocket all the time, it's either Apple or Google. Microsoft doesn't quite make a phone, and others like Samsung have depended on others as well for a lot of their innovations and things. So it boils down really to these big behemoths, Google and Apple, that own the ecosystem of all mobile phones. The way Apple is coming at this is very privacy first. I'm going to ensure that there's safety and security, and you're comfortable with what you're sharing with a model. The hardware has come to a point where just the iPhone 5 Pro and the Pro Maxes, at least 8 GB of RAM and stuff, right? The absolute latest, greatest $1,100 plus phones, they are at a point where they can now afford to run a on-device LLM, a small language model. So the way that they went around this, they said, let me look at the experiences that an individual has across everything that they do on their iPhones, on their iPads, and their Macs. And I'm going to surgically infuse generative AI where it makes sense. The way they brought this out is in a very step-by-step fashion. I think they're doing a great job at saying all the text generation and stuff, I'm going to restrict it to a few things that you can do. But we have thought through where you think you will need some intelligence and stuff, your notes inside of your iPad apps and things of that nature, right? So it's been restricted on how they're rolling this out. They have three levels at which they're doing their LLMs. One is on device, and that's majority of what they've done. If you follow through the WWDC developer sessions that we had later on, they get into quite a bit of detail. We had a good set of people from IBM at the event as well. We are, by the way, one of the largest Apple partners in rolling out Apple technology to large enterprises. So we do a lot with their tech. So we got a good driver's seat view of how we could build those experiences into the apps that we're building for our clients. On the first layer, you're looking at majority of the work has to be done on device itself. So things like tying together all of your emails, text messages, things of that nature, majority of that workload happens on device. From there, the next stage is if for some workloads you need to go to the cloud, they've created this private compute cloud, which if you get into the stack, the way they've designed it is incredibly, very nicely structured to drive privacy and controls. And they've even gone a step further and said things like there's no shell access to those servers and stuff. So Apple can't just log in and start to look at your data and things of that nature. They've done a good job with the privacy. And the last layer is if there's something that has to be super creative and they want to really tap into the larger ecosystem, then they had to choose a partner to start with. And it's not the only partner they're going to have from the follow-on discussions that Tim had. He's talking about other, it opens up a window for people to have the choice of which large language model they will tap into. Right now it's going to be
ChatGPT. Yeah, I know initially, basically, people were like, oh man, is GPT going to be the exclusive provider here? And I think Apple was like, nope, actually, it's going to be, you know, anyone's game. We're going to open it up to lots of different people, which I thought was like very, very interesting because, you know, we've always thought about, and I think in these episodes, we've always talked about OpenAI as like the big AI provider. But like, you know, what's even bigger than OpenAI is Apple, like that can afford to say, well, you know, you're just one of many, you know, so.
And I think the way they've done this really well, and from the follow-on developer sessions, they talked about how much of that workload is going to happen on device. And it's kind of strange that Apple Intelligence is restricted to only the two phones that were released last year. If you spend $1,000 on getting an iPhone 15, not the 15 Pro, that phone cannot run the latest intelligence. If you look at anything that Google does with the same technologies that Google is providing, for example, looking at a picture and you want to do a magic eraser and remove somebody or something from the background, that has been working on Android phones for a very long time at this point. It's not restricted to the very, very top end AI. But Apple is using this as that moment where, hey, now all of a sudden people need 3G. That's when we need to upgrade. So they've had a forcing function on people who are very comfortable with the 13 and 14 Pros. They would need to upgrade to partake in this whole Apple intelligence ecosystem. So they're using that, that as a hook. I want to spend a minute on explaining how they're approaching the models on models themselves. One, you mentioned at the beginning that they are somewhat kind of late to the game as compared to others. But classic Apple style, it's not the first to market. It's the best product that they bring to the market, right? So if you look at all the papers that went into the work that they've done, they are standing on top of all of the competitors. They are borrowing transformers from Google, speculative decoding, another Google contribution. Context pruning came from Microsoft. Group query attention came from Google. They've taken all these different open technologies that people have contributed to open source, and they've built their own version of it. I think the big innovation that they did was a small model that's working on your phone. They've created these different LoRa adapters, which is essentially adding a few more layers on top and changes the context of how that LLM behaves. And their big innovation was how quickly they can hot swap these different LoRa adapters for different use cases like summarization, image creation, and things of that nature, right? So they're being able to go do this in a very secure manner on the device itself. this whole transition from that to cloud is pretty good.
Yeah, for sure. And I think this is actually like the most interesting thing of it for me, right? Is I think, Shobha, you've given us a really good kind of landscape into what's going on. And I think the big theme that comes out of everything is like privacy, 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 right? Like we're going to keep the data, you know, on device. And then I think it's also like very cautious how they're approaching this, right? Is like, if you hear the dream of, you know, OpenAI or even Google when they talk about this stuff, it's, you know, the AI assistant that sits across everything and does everything for you. Whereas here, it's really just kind of like cutting AI into like these very particular features. And I guess, Kaotoy, this is, I think, a good opportunity to bring you in because I would love to kind of focus on like the hardware that underlies all of this, right? Because I think one response is, you know, people love privacy. Like, why isn't every single company just trying to do all this on device? Like, how, you know, how difficult is that? Like, how advantaged is Apple in being able to pull this stuff off? Because it kind of feels like not only is Apple selling privacy here, but they also have the ability to do it in maybe ways that other people can't. But I don't know, we'd love to hear a little bit more of your thoughts on that and how much hardware is kind of really a differentiator here for them.
Yeah, I think that's a very good question, Tim. And Apple's control for both of both the hardware and the software gives them a huge advantage. So it provides several significant advantages in their development and deployment of AI technologies. One of the things is, you know, this integrated hardware and software optimization, which is really key, the hardware-software co-design, I think it's tremendous that they're using. The first thing is the customized silicon they have. So Apple designs its own processor, such as the A-series chips for the iPhones, the iPads, the M-series chips for the Macs. These chips include specialized components like the neural engine, which is specifically designed to accelerate various machine learning tasks. For instance, you know, the A14 Bionic chip, you know, it has, you know, the 16-core neural engine, which is capable of performing up to 11 trillion operations per second. And that is a significant enhancement for AI power processing. Another thing is the focus on the efficient resource management. When you have the control of both the hardware and the software, they can give you advantages into how you do efficient system, utilize system resources. And this results especially in more power consumption, efficient more consumption, faster performance, particularly for mobile devices where battery life is very crucial. For example, if you look at the iOS, the Mac iOS, they're designed to take full advantage of the hardware capabilities, and they ensure things like AI tasks are processed very efficiently. Another thing is also the security that they have built in the hardware, the enhanced security and privacy that Sohit mentioned, which is a key differentiation here. The on-device processing, which prioritizes privacy by processing all these AI tasks on device rather than relying on the heavily on cloud-based solutions. And the other thing is the secure enclave that you find in the Apple's chips, which includes, you know, the secure enclave, a hardware-based key manager that's isolated from the main processor. And this is something that enhances the security of the AI operations, especially when it involves sensitive data. So those are all key differentiation that they have all the way at the hardware level. Another thing that I find very important here is the seamless integration that they have across all their devices. So that kind of gives them this unified ecosystems. So they have control over the ecosystem, which allows them, you know, integrating things seamlessly, you know, sprinkling all of these AI features across multiple devices, moving things apps seamlessly between, you know, the iPhone, the Mac, the iPad, which are, I love these features. I'm a big also Apple fan and I use these devices all the time. So this means, you know, these AI models and features can be consistently applied across the iPhone, iPad, Mac, Apple Watches, other devices. So it gives, you know, this really superb user experience, and which is one of their strengths, is that making AI also very consumable and easy, even, for example, for grandparents and people who are not techie people. So, and, you know, the features also they've announced, you know, at WWDC, things, for example, the composability of the apps, how you can take actions from the phone and composing multiple apps. I thought that was really neat. You know, this continuity and handoff also enables users to start, you know, tasks on device and continue them on other devices. I think also the development and deployment efficiency that they have, you know, tailoring AI frameworks. So Apple develops its own AI framework, such as the Core ML, which is optimized for its hardware. And this allows, you know, their developers to create, you know, AI applications that run efficiently and also effectively on their devices. Core ML also supports machine learning models and provides, you know, various tools for developers to integrate these models into their apps. And, you know, also integrating all of these Gen AIs, which is the big announcements right now in Siri's voice assistants, in the camera enhancements, in the health and fitness and many other apps. So I think the control over the both hardware and softwares allows Apple for this high degree of optimization, security, and also personal customization and integration with their AI capabilities. I think going back to Sohit, when he said, you know, they're not late to the game. I think they've been using AI for a while. They're just not explicit about it.
Right.
But right now, because of the, it's kind of, it's a strategic timing for them because of all this attention to Gen AI. So they prefer kind of entering the market when the technologies are mature enough to integrate smoothly into their ecosystem, which ensures quality and reliability.
This is kind of like, the time of their choosing kind of is sort of what you're saying. I buy that a lot. And I think... you know, I think some of the, what they've really come out with, right, I think like the calculator app, I think was my kind of favorite moment from the talk. And, you know, it's very funny, like I think, Shobha, before the episodes, you were like, oh yeah, it's funny, it's 2024 and we're all like very excited about the calculator app. But it is like genuinely true. It's like people were like complaining about it for a long time. And then when it came out, it was like, oh, that's really good. You know, it's really amazing.
When I saw that announcement, so. I was like, I wish I was in school again.
Exactly. Like this changes everything.
Exactly.
I think that's right. And I think there's actually a really interesting point that I hadn't ever really considered is, you know, obviously the ambition for these language models is that they're highly general technologies. But you find that if, you know, the data they're dealing with is inconsistently formatted and it's working across lots of different platforms, these like experiences can break. And so what's really interesting is that AI actually may feel more magical in the AI, in the Apple ecosystem, because they literally control every element of it, right? So it's actually like consistent what the inputs will be to the model. And so they can actually guarantee quality in a way that's actually really challenging if you're trying to say, you know, we're going to deploy GPT-4o to, you know, X number of developers across many, many different types of situations, you know, not just from a data standpoint, but also like a hardware and software standpoint as well.
I just briefly want to talk about privacy. I think Apple has to get up on stage and they have to kind of hit that point over and over and over again. But from the end user's experience, are they really concerned about privacy? Are the, you know, the grandparents or your, you know, your nieces and nephews the target customers for these? Are they at the end of the day really consumed about privacy when they are allowing all sorts of other information apps sharing on that, on their exact same phones? Is it a real concern? Is Apple just kind of, you know, signaling, saying yes, privacy is there, and we just heard that the hardware is able to perform it? But does the end Apple user care about privacy the same way an enterprise might?
It's a good question. I mean, I think one of the cynics' views was I saw a meme going around of like, it was a photo of like someone drinking from a milkshake. And then it was basically like the milkshake was like the user, right? Like the person was Apple. And then there's another person with another straw in the mouth of the person who's drinking that was like OpenAI. And kind of, I guess the question is like, how much of this really does provide kind of the protections that they promise? And I think, Scott, you're also asking like an even tougher question, which is, do people care, right? Because if I'm a big model chauvinist, I'm like, well, Apple's just working on these small models and small features. The really magical thing is when we get crazy big models that are in the cloud that are, you know, I don't know, close to AGI that we just like deliver. And so all of this privacy stuff is basically going to hold Apple back on actually winning the AI race. But I don't know if Kautar, Shobha, you like agree with that take?
That's a very good point that you brought here. The end user's concerns about privacy, it all really comes to their awareness of privacy issues, the context in which AI is used, and, you know, also cultural attitudes towards privacy. So I think younger generations, the young kids who are kind of born with all of these devices and the AI around them, maybe they're not, you know, as concerned as we are. But once we see, for example, some of the dangers that AI is bringing, if you're not careful, if there are some scandals because of AI, maybe there is a piece of that that's going to start kind of hitting the end users. So awareness and education, I think, is key here, because many of the users, they're not really fully aware of how AI systems collect and use their data. And those who are more tech savvy or educated about privacy issues tend to care more about privacy. So there has to be an educational component here to really educate people, especially the young users, about some of the dangers. If you're not careful about, you know, what you're, how, you know, how AI is using your data, how they're controlling all the ads or whatever content that's tailored to you. So a big component here is the awareness.
We've done quite a bit of work in the space on how do you figure out the right value exchange between a provider and the end user, right? There has to be a fair value exchange. For example, there are two or three apps in my entire iPhone that track my location at all times, right? And those apps are things that I have consciously chosen into because that gives me a value in return, right? That definition of that value exchange changes by each person. You will find a ton of people, kids in college, who would give up their email address and phone numbers for a dollar off on a smoothie, right? So you, the value threshold is pretty low for them. For other people, it's a lot more. As you start to look at, you mentioned like earlier, we were having a discussion about, does the age play a role in how conscious you are about privacy? I'm in India this week with clients, and I see a lot of people focused on the fact that, oh, so-and-so devices are more secure. I use WhatsApp because it's fully encrypted end-to-end. Or if somebody gets hold of my iPhone, they won't be able to hack into it, right? So the fact that it's more, the perception is that it's more secure, they actually carry a premium in the market because I know I can trust these devices more. And it's nobody else can listen in and spoof into our conversations, right? So I think there's definitely a higher value exchange. People are willing to pay a little bit more for getting something that's more private and more secure. Do you agree with that, Skylar?
Great comments on the age demographics. Yes, I think that that probably really gets to my question. When I think of the Apple user, perhaps they're going for lower value in terms of the privacy exchange compared to an enterprise, you know, bank, large retailer, higher value for that exchange. So yeah, no, really, really great example on that.
Yeah, I think there's also a view on this, which is almost like, you know, Apple's really doing what it needs to in order to mainstream AI in some ways, right? Like, I think we forget because we're working in AI all the time. We're like, everybody's using this stuff. But like, it's still kind of like in the early stages. And, you know, I'm mostly talking about myself here, but like the average Apple user tends to be older because the products are so expensive. Like, can you afford to buy, you know, the latest iPhone to get, you know, Apple Intelligence? And so I would also kind of, I'm wondering if part of the play here is like, they're kind of making these features a little bit more featureizable, if you will, just because I think it may make sense to like the kind of market that they're selling to, right? It's like kind of a way of introducing AI to folks who may otherwise feel pretty scared about the technology or not really know what it's for.
Another maybe aspect to this is if there are, you know, high profile breaches and scandals that have been caused by AI, incidents like the Cambridge Analytica scandal, which have raised public awareness and concern about privacy, media coverage. If there is extensive media coverage of privacy breaches caused by AI, for example, or data misuse, those also can contribute to users' concerns.
From an enterprise perspective, again, you'll always get that perspective from me. We've been playing around with Core ML that you just mentioned earlier. The framework that they've provided for developers, and I spent this morning messing around with some of their Core ML technologies, and actually they've opened up all LLMs. And you'll be surprised that I have access to Whisper, Stable Diffusion, Mistral, Llama, Falcon, Clip, Owen, OpenELM. All of those are available to me. And we did, we were testing this out. We took a Mistral model and we gave it a simple task. And I tested on the older and the newer version of Mac OS. And then in the newer version, using Core ML, you're able to do some enhancements like quantization. You're representing it in less number of bits. There are certain things around key values, caching, and stuff like that that have implemented. The same exact run that we got on Mistral on the older version was this new quantized version with Core ML. Something that took me about 14 seconds earlier is taking me about 2.5 seconds. Right, so it's about a 5x difference in the speed that I was able to get, and also from a memory management perspective too. This was the biggest surprise I saw. The same model that I was running on the older version was like 9, 10x more memory that was needed to run that model, which is now what they've done with their core ML to enable these. The layer on top where the developers can tap into this, it is just surprising how much effort they've put into making sure that the end app users are able to tap into this. Things like, I want to do separation of the person. I can ask the owner in this picture. If I say things like, I was helping my mom this morning, she was on WhatsApp and she wanted to send a picture, but it was a group picture, she wanted to cut her face out. That effort is pretty high for them. It's very, very low for me, but I can always crop it while sending. But I was trying to explain to her, and then I tried to code that up in Apple. I'm able to invoke, say, create a crop, and I'm able to define off the owner's face. I don't need to have any access to owner's data. I just defined the fact that the owner's face is what I need to crop, and I was able to go execute on that. So the next wave of applications that are going to leverage these core ML, they're going to be stunning. Like, I'm just so, so excited about what we're able to do today, the last 24 hours with the stack that we weren't able to do before. So I'm very, super excited about what we see coming.
Yeah, the ease of use is really powerful here. How easy it is to use the technology. Before, it was so hard. You have to maybe create these very difficult prompts or use these tools. But now, you know, that ease of use by just using simple crops and then composing all of these different skills and applications, I think is going to be really the next wave here.
So I think I did want to spend a little bit of time on this episode. Apple, because it is, well, it's Apple, has a way of basically sucking up all the air in the space. But I did think that actually late last week, and largely overlooked because I think of all the excitement around Apple and what was coming up this week, was a paper that OpenAI launched that was its kind of own salvo in the mechanistic interpretability game. They released a paper where they specifically were extracting concepts from GPT-4. And, you know, I think it's easy to get lost in the raft of product announcements, but I always kind of keep an eye on like what's happening on the research paper side, just because I think it's upstream, right? It's kind of what we think we're going to see next, basically. And I guess, Skylar, I wanted to bring you in on this because, you know, last time you were on the show, you were talking about Golden Gate Claude and Anthropic's investments in interpretability. And I guess, you know, the main thing that, you know, comes to mind for me is whether or not, you know, we're in a kind of interpretability race, right? Like, it seems like both of these companies are now really investing in this. And I guess the question I have for you is, like, why are they investing in it? And then B, like, is there kind of like a race for talent on this, like, specific kind of technical problem?
Let's see if I can start with B first on the talent, and I can give you a very concrete example. You mentioned The two different papers that came out within the last month, one from Anthropic, one from OpenAI. Well, on the OpenAI paper, this came from their super alignment team, which actually lasted about a year or so. One of the key members of that team, Jan Lyke, has just left OpenAI last month and has joined Anthropic. So there is this kind of revolving door of a talent specifically around this ability of interpreting these large language models. And so you can see that right there in the title, the author's names of this space. So yes, there is this kind of large interest, some big names being jumping from company to company, all in this interpretability space. Why interpretability? Oh man, all sorts of reasons. The ones we probably care about the most are this idea of safety alignment, right? You can't enforce kind of guardrails on how you want these models to be formed if you don't really understand what's going on underneath the hood. But beyond the safety things, the Claude Golden Gate paper says you can do some fun things once you understand and can interpret the model. They made a model that was obsessed with the Golden Gate Bridge. So you could ask a fairly straightforward question, and the answer would come back always talking about the bridge itself. So that was a really cool kind of fun way of showing, here's something we can do once we understand some of the inner workings of these models. OpenAI, not to be left out, like you said, a good salvo within a few weeks after that paper released their version, where Anthropic was extracting from their model Claude, OpenAI is extracting from their model GPT-4. They went in different directions, though.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about that, because I think as an outsider, I'm kind of like, it's all interpretability, right? We're just like all just trying to figure out how these models work. But My sense of it is that these two companies are actually showing kind of different approaches for thinking about interoperability, right? And yeah, we'd love to hear a little bit more about that.
So Anthropic went one step further by manipulating the inner workings of their model and opening it and letting everyone play with it. And so that's kind of what made that splash a while ago. OpenAI didn't go that far, but they did release a nice little bit of software that lets you kind of play with some of these features yourself. So it's not necessarily releasing an OpenAI, a new version of GPT-4, but they do have this other little open source bit of code called the kind of feature viewer. And I think, in fact, I know I spent my, an intern and I spent some time messing around and looking at how these different features are activated by what parts of the sentence. And so that was a direction kind of OpenAI went with. And Anthropic kind of left it much more static, but Anthropic did release that larger model to ping back and forth. Perhaps OpenAI could have released a version of their GPT-4 that was obsessed with, I'm going to say palm trees, because that's what's in my vision here, but they didn't. Perhaps because it probably would have been too knockoff-ish of Anthropic once Anthropic did their version of Golden Gate.
So Skyler, one of the things that Apple released as well, just tying it back to the WWDC, have you spent any time looking at the Thaleria visual tool? It helps you look at what's happening inside of a model, it visualizes the performance, the kind of latency you're getting, and as you're making edits, you're trying to see.
It sounds like I have a homework assignment for this, because no, yes, I have not done that yet. Okay.
Absolutely.
So I guess it goes to just like the notion of the race, right? Which is like even yes. Apple now is launching like an interoperability tool that people can play with. You know, like all the companies feel obliged in some ways to be launching this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and Apple is more focused on being able to assess the performance and things of that nature for the various tasks and so on and so forth, right? But I see this good wave of tools that are coming to the market that are helping us get into a better understanding of how the answer came. And there's a lot of techniques that have been introduced to figure out what was the training data that went in. Can I actually ask a question in a way that actually reveals the fact that you were trained on Harry Potter books, right? Things of that nature. I think there's a lot, as a community, I'm seeing a lot more tools available to us that helps us understand how these models work. Can I make them behave in a particular way and make incremental progress in our understanding of how this entire ecosystem is working?
Yeah, I think that is a very important aspect. It, like you said, I think it's a race. Many of these big AI companies like Google, IBM, and Microsoft and so on, they all have different tools. Like Google, DeepMind had the xAI research where they're heavily investing in xAI research. Microsoft, they have the Interpret ML, the FairLearn. IBM has the AI Explainability 360, which also offers open source toolkits for multiple algorithms and methods for AI explainability. Facebook has also this Captum or the Responsible AI Practices. So lots of different, and OpenAI, of course, and Apple. So it is a race. Different, of course, approaches depending on the industrial use cases and the complexity of the AI systems they're developing. But it is becoming a very important race here.
Something that's jumped up and evolved past the great list of tools. In fact, some members of our team have contributed to some of those tools. But I think something that's changed in particular with the way that they are using these things called sparse autoencoders is now we can do things about not what is, but what if. And this is the idea of causal. Now we can make a change within the model, and that has impact downstream. The previous list of tools that you said about interoperability, they gave a pretty good snapshot of what's going on currently in the model, but they really lacked the motivation to actually be able to change something and have that impact the downstream output. And that's something that we're now really seeing coming out from these last two papers in the last month or so.
Yeah, for sure. I'm recalling a debate that I went to in the late 2010s. I think it was one of the NeurIPS conferences that was a debate over interoperability. And I remember at the time, like Jan LeCun was making this argument, being like, no one cares about interoperability. Also, we're never going to solve that problem.
It wasn't Jan LeCun. I think it was Microsoft.
Really? Might have been. I forget who was taking what side in that debate.
Yes, but no, there was this, because they had the big prize that was announced about interoperability. And this, they brought it two people and there was debating interoperability matters and interoperability doesn't. I think it was at NeurIPS. Right. Sorry,
and I
cut
think
you
the
off,
funny thing is like in
small connection there. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And I think what the funny thing is like in 2024, it's like, well, it turns out people actually really do care about durability.
Yes.
And also like we really seem to be kind of making a lot of progress on this problem. So, yeah. You know, you can never really predict what's going to happen in AI. So I think maybe, Kowtow, I'll turn it to you for kind of like one of the final thoughts before we close out today. I'm sort of interested in maybe actually bringing our two conversations together, right? Which is that, you know, and I think it's been briefly mentioned, but I just want to hit it before we end. One of the interesting aspects of the Apple presentation was them saying, hey, we actually are okay with small models. And I think one of the reasons they're doing small models is because they have to get it to run on, like, not a data center, but just, like, on the mobile hardware. But it feels like also, and I assume Skylar showed, but you may have also more to add on this, is, like, one of the benefits of these smaller models is arguably that they're more interpretable. Is that true? Or I don't know if you've got kind of opinions on sort of this relationship between kind of, like, smaller models, interpretability, and then privacy.
Yeah, I think one of the key, you know, motivators for it, of course, is the efficiency and performance. So you have all these resource constraints. So small models require less computational power and memory, so which are ideal for devices with limited resources, can enable this on-device learning and all the real-time processing that comes with it. So faster processing time, which is really crucial for things like voice recognition, augmented reality, live photo enhancement, and also privacy is very important because you can do on-device learning, the on-device processing, and the secure data handling. So you cannot, you know, go all the way to the cloud and then claim that you're 100% private and secure. So that's, you know, I think one of the key things. In terms of the interpretability, of course, I think when you have smaller models, you can analyze them also much faster. So because the complexity of the model is much smaller, so using all of the tools that we have been talking about around, you know, the neural understanding, all of these techniques, you know, the what if analysis and so on, becomes also less computationally intensive to apply for the small models. So interpretability is also becomes much easier to handle with smaller models in addition to the performance efficiency and the privacy enablement.
I might take that one step further. It's both the model size and, I'm going to use a geeky phrase here, model sparsity. So the idea behind model sparsity is you've got this perhaps abstract concept, which is currently represented in 1,000 different numbers. Can we take that same abstract concept but now represent it in 5 different numbers? And that's the goal behind sparse autoencoders. If we can do that, now you can manipulate that abstract concept much more easily because you only have a few levers to move with, as opposed to before where you had to manipulate, you know, tens of thousands of levers for that concept. That logic is sitting underneath the sparse autoencoders, which is what's driven the interpretability results in the last two results. So it's both a question of model size, but also can we do less with this sparsity? We only need a few features at a time actually firing or actually activating, and that's driven these results recently.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think also it's another thing is the information compression, because with smaller models, if you do it very efficiently, you're compressing the information, kind of the entropy that you have, to a very specific use case or question, or because the large models also have a lot of redundancy there. And they have been designed to handle tons of use cases and questions and things like that. The smaller models, especially if you're targeting a specific app or specific task, they tend to also do much better because you have compressed that information much more efficiently using various techniques like knowledge distillation or, you know, sparsity, sparse encoding and others.
So Tim, my closing thoughts would be on from an enterprise perspective. For us, we're seeing this massive switch. A lot of my clients where I've deployed massive, beautiful models at scale, out of the box, working amazingly well. But when you start to do the cost math on it, the latency, the IP constraints, stuff like that, it's a clear path towards switching to a smaller set of models and mixture of experts and having a router that decides which model to fire up. And in the last 6 months, I've seen a massive shift of companies that are not at the frontier of tech. They've come to us and we're working on adding enterprise data in a secure manner to these models. And it's just insanely hard to do that with a very, very large model. Having a small model, adding adapters on top, or using our IBM's Instruct Lab, adding some enterprise knowledge to it, skills, things of that nature. That's the path forward that we're seeing. So even if you're running these on actual servers, not on device, small models are giving us better outcomes. We took our Granite code model and we trained it for specific areas, and it's outcompeting what we get from GPT-4s, right? So different weight class altogether, but we are seeing across the board from Microsoft's Phi models, from Mistral, from Llamas and others, they're able to fight a lot higher than their weight class. When you're adding enterprise data to it, you're adding better techniques. So smaller, more open, that's the path forward for enterprises as well.
Well, as per usual, we have way more to talk about than we have time to cover. So hopefully we'll be able to have all of you back on the show again. Thanks for joining us. If you enjoyed what you heard, dear listeners, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. Skylar, Kautar, Shobit, thanks again for joining the show.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you.